Hey, how's everybody doing? It's John here once again, back from an unintended hiatus, and I was hoping we could talk. With Dragon Age Origins upon us, I've been getting ready for that with yet another playthrough of an old favorite of mine, one of BioWare's earlier titles, Them and Black Isle. I'm talking, of course, about Baldur's Gate. Going back through the series reminded me of a few things, how comically broken the second edition of D&D was, how the answer to a cheese boss fight was to counter with your own cheese, and how flat out hard and unfair those older RPGs could be. It reminded me of a few other things, too. How big those old games were. How much content was packed into every city block, every acre of forest hiding some adventure. How great the characters were, a lively bunch, brilliantly acted even when they were hamming it up. In fact, especially when they were hamming it up. How tight the writing and scripting was, even if the karma system boiled down to rescuing cats from trees or cutting the tree down and then eating the cat. But the writing, whew, man, the writing was good stuff. Plots were clever, villains improvised, characters were well aware of genre tropes even as they played right into others, and for all the silliness of the romance subplots, there was genuine, honest-to-goodness character growth in them. There's a larger point on one of the ways a game can get around technical faults, namely by delivering a quality adventure, but let's focus on the disparity between the good and the bad parts, because the bad parts are what a newcomer's gonna notice first. And we, those of us that play PC role-playing games, we were all new to this once. We all got our asses kicked and said, "Fuck this game," at some point. This is not a series whose tutorials, shall we say, adequately prepare a player for the game. In fact, there's almost a schizophrenic quality to the game. Like, half of it's awesome, and half of it's you getting the shit beat out of you. It's almost sadistic, the kind of game that should be played with a safe word or a trained medical professional nearby. I'll elaborate. For those new to this series, the gist of Baldur's Gate is that you, the player, roll up a character and have to go from an 8-hit point weakling to kicking ass all up and down the D&D-based Forgotten Realms. Typical medieval fantasy slash political intrigue slash Child of Destiny stuff. You start the first game an orphan whose foster father, a rather powerful wizard and adventurer, is killed right in front of you. You barely survive and find yourself neck deep in local concerns, namely a strange iron shortage that seems manufactured, while trying to figure out why the killers seem interested in you. In the second, you get kidnapped by a mage named John Arrhenicus, who's taken a keen interest in unlocking your quote-unquote inner power by torturing you and performing rather sick experiments. You break out and find yourself in a foreign city where magic is tightly regulated. To wit, during your escape, a group of cowled wizards, basically magic police, they take both you, your captor, and one of your friends into custody. Job one is finding out where they went. Job two is finding out what Irenicus wanted from you. Now, none of this matters at first because both games have a rather steep learning curve. In the first game, it's all you can do to handle a pack of diseased gibberlings or a single wolf, and God help you if you stumble across an angry bear. When you do fight, it's that old standby made famous in Morrowind. You basically whiff at your target until the computer decides one of you scored a hit. Granted, hits get more common, way, way more common, as you level up, but early on it's not rare to get your clock clean just because there were six goblins with poison arrows hiding just off-screen, and oh hey, look who just aggroed the whole pack at once. It seems everywhere you go, there's an assassin out for your head, or a trap you didn't know to look for, or some mage who decided he hasn't flipped out and thrown fireballs all over the place lately. Meanwhile, your mage gets to cast magic missile once and then has to go hide until the next day. Oh, and due to the Iron Crisis, your unenchanted weapons occasionally break. Good luck, fucker. Game two ups the stupid ante. You hit more often, and your mage has expanded their chanting vocabulary with spells that are actually useful, but everything is still out to get you. You're trying to take back some nice girl's castle, and hey, those big Umber Hulk can confuse your party members before curb stomping you. And those trolls have to be knocked down and then killed with fire or acid, but they're not falling down because you're hitting them fast enough to interrupt their animation. Every mage in the game has contingency and sequencer set up so their spells fire immediately, while you're still trying to figure out if you need to cast Breach or Dispel Magic or Dispel Illusion, and they made their save versus spells so your dispel didn't do jack shit and he's throwing around Cloud Kill or one of the six different Charm Person spells. And this is before you get to the real cheating bastards of this game. I'll take clay golems, for instance. They can only be damaged with blunt weapons, and if you're like me, the first time you learn will be when the only one person in the party has them. They also slow your party and travel with other golems that can haste themselves. Or the other way around, I think. They all look the same. And there's another. Oh, the Illithid. Let me tell you about these assholes. They're a race of psionics that literally eat brains. They've got a group stun attack they can use at range, and their attacks drain intelligence, so they can kill anything in about two or three hits. They show up in large groups, and later in the game, you might have to clear out a whole map of these dicks. And then there's the Beholders. Picture that giant floating head eye thing from Lo Pan's fortress in Big Trouble in Little China, only bigger and pissed off. Anyway, they have gaze attacks, which they inflict all sorts of status headaches at range, and the larger ones can imprison party members. There's no save by that, by the way, and you gotta cast this spell that's impossible to find to free them. And they show up in large numbers too. Fuck them. I can quite literally go on for days about the number of ways the series tries to curb stomp you. Oh man, does it try. But there are two very big saving graces. I'll touch on the one most relevant to gameplay first, because at the same time the game seems horribly broken, it can also be horribly broken in your favor. Play your cards right, and it's you doing the curb stomping, and instead of feeling like the poorly balanced mess that by all rights it should be, it comes off as empowering, cathartic, deeply, utterly satisfying. Let's take the biggest example, literally. Dragon fights. Boss fights without peer. Massive engines of pure destruction with a score of powers to ruin your day. But at some point, you start thinking you can take these things. You start figuring out how to lead with an expendable summoned skeleton or two, having your mage throw down a breach spell from afar and buff up your party with haste. You get your cleric to throw down bless and strength of one. You pelt the bastard with magic missiles as you charge in. And suddenly, you're doing damage. Little bit at first, but it adds up. Now maybe you lose the first time, but you know it can be done. These things aren't invincible. You mess with strategies. You pull someone back if they're hurt. You chug a potion. You get hate onto someone else. You set traps and lure the thing in close to set them off. Before you know it, the big guy goes down. And you realize something. You've grown. You've gotten better. You're learning. Then you get higher level abilities like Whirlwind, Critical Strike, better weapons, better saving throws and spells, and before you know it, you've got multiple sets of armor made out of dragon scales. Here's another example. Vampires. You're plot-bound to fight these things, and they're a pain. They've got gaze-based charm spells, level-draining attacks, they usually appear in large numbers, and even one or two can be a real problem at first. But as you grow, you learn how to fight them. You start getting abilities just for them. For instance, Sunray or the spell False Dawn. They have a chance to destroy the things outright, groups of them, all at once. Your cleric's Turn Undead ability, if it's strong enough, can do a bunch of nasty things depending on the cleric's alignment. Evil characters can control them into fighting each other. Good characters can simply make them explode. You start getting equipment to protect against level drain, or do extra damage to the undead. Or maybe you just push the Berserk button on Minsk and send him in. Immunity to level drain and any form of mind control or stun, and his racial nemesis is the vampire, meaning he gets a bonus for dealing with them. Just send him in, close the door behind him, go make a sandwich or something, and come back to a shiny new level up. Piece of cake. As long as I could talk about the game's cheating bastards, I could talk even longer about the ways to get around them. You got Illithid? Set traps and deploy archers, or send in Minsk. Enemy mages? Insect Swarm shuts them right down, keeps them from casting, or even the low-level Stinking Cloud basically just knocks them out, and you can just pick them off at range. The big golem that only takes 2 points of damage per hit? Get him stuck in a door or a bridge, make sure it's, you know, too small for him to get through, and just belt his stupid ass to death with rocks. Room full of beholders? Your own range attacks do the job nicely, or just get the shield of Beldurand from the Adventure Mart, which reflects beholder rays right back at them. Problem solved. Demilich that comes back to life even more powerful after you kill it the first time and it starts imprisoning party members? Put on a protection from magic scroll, grab a +4 weapon, and kill that bitch again. You scrape by those weaker fights, working your way up until you're smiting every last thing that ever dared cross you. You can do the long, roundabout, stealthy quest if you prefer, taking the guise as someone else to sneak into a city and blend into their culture so you can steal something from under their noses, all very complex, or you can kill your way in, take the item, and kill your way out. You can duck and weave with the Beholder cult until you get a magical item with the power to take it down, or you can just waltz into their lair, provoke the Beholder, bash its eye in, and leave. You can make nice with a chronic backstabber. You can vaporize him in the split second before he runs off and just find another way. Hell, you can forego a party and just do it yourself. Build a character to solo the whole damn game. Do the impossible. Kill the unkillable. Pierce the heavens. Row, row, fight the etc. You get the idea. That's the gameplay of Baldur's Gate. And it's all you, all the way up. Now, if killing was all there was to this game, it wouldn't be nearly as popular. Now, make no mistake, you are gonna kill a lot of dudes. Like, you could probably fill a stadium with that. Like, if you cremated them, you could probably fill the stadium with their ashes. What I'm getting at is you're going to kill a lot of dudes. Hard to overstate that. But there is more to it than that. Thing is, at first glance, it seems like the story throws itself headlong into cliché and doesn't look back. Orphan with a mysterious past, your home-slash-adopted family are lost to you, you've got big conspiracies with powerful figures showing a clear interest not only in stopping you, but also who you are and who your real family is. The plot's pretty linear. You're allowed to wander, but you're going from A to B to C eventually. Some of the dialogue reads good on paper, but is wordy as hell to say aloud, which makes it a good thing that not all dialogue is voiced. The actors you do hear, it's pretty much a world of ham. I mean, D&D is a world where people fall neatly into alignment categories, so the good guys are all righteous and pure, the bad guys are all evil mustache twirlers for various reasons. There's an assload of angst to go around, and all the shades of female elven cleric want to jump the male player character's bones. So why is this good? It sounds trite, but it's hard to put into words. You gotta get past the surface, because there's a quality that's hard to pin down. It comes from how these personalities interact, how the story unfolds. It comes from realizing that, yes, these are stock characters in a stock situation, but they do grow. They do change. The situation changes. The world changes. And it's believable and entertaining from start to finish. There's a quality to the writing, both the script and the scripting. Let's work by way of example. The first game is more adventure-focused, with your party trying to figure out who's behind this Iron Crisis and who wanted you dead. Just by saying that, you're probably already thinking the two are related, and the game does telegraph some of its punches, but the plot is actually pretty clever. You know there's conspiracy afoot, something linking this brittle iron to the bandit attacks. Someone is exploiting this to their advantage, that much is obvious. Rumor has it the neighboring country of Om or agents of the Zentarum are behind this, but you know it's not that simple. So you dig. You poke around the only functioning mine in the country. You find out miners are disappearing. Monsters are being marshaled deep in the pits somehow. You find bandits operating on a centralized staging areas, clearly with local backing, and that not even their bosses are 100% clear on who they're working for. But you follow the clues. You unravel the operation, and the attempts on your life grow more serious. All the while, something is whispering in the back of your skull, showing you nightmares of your fallen foes, telling you one thing over and over again. You will learn. It's the adventure, however, the process of uncovering this conspiracy, that's a big part of the appeal. I mean, just getting up the road is a feat, as all manner of bandits, monsters, and such infest the wilds outside of towns. A trip off the beaten path reveals all sorts of a curious encounters. A wandering healer seeking repentance, an insane guard captain who butchered his own family, a party of hunters and druids squaring off, message runners, a woman seeking her lost child on a lonely stretch of coast, a farmer trying to fend off a zombie incursion. The list goes on. Even plot-related areas are often out of the way, as a trip into the Cloakwood Forest spans 5 distinct zones, each with its own mini-quests and hazards. It can be frustrating. It can be slow. But the first gate knows how to make you feel like a small fish in a very, very big pond. The second game is definitely more character-focused, as the plot seems to center around you in particular, and what this Irenicus wanted from you. He and Imowen may now be prisoners of the state, but you know it's not over. You saw the creatures in his lab, you remember the bizarre experiments, the fleshy monstrosities, the cloned women, the trapped, pristine bedroom. This wasn't some 2-bit mage with a hard-on for power. He was after you, something you had deep down inside. But for what? And what do? Go back to your life, wait until he breaks out of prison, which he surely will, being so powerful, and comes to get you again? Or what about your friend, Imowen? He seemed interested in her, too. You can't petition the government to release her. They don't even know where the mage prison spellhold is, and the cowled wizards pretty much do what they want. You need to go through them, and for that you need a plan. As it turns out, other people have done the planning for you. Some have taken an interest in Irenicus, too, and your pursuit of him. Strangers approach you in the streets, petitioning you for an exchange of gold and services. Surely this has nothing to do with the open war in the streets between rival gangs of thieves, both of whom you saw in the lab. It's difficult to explain without really spoiling the game, but suffice it to say the pursuit of Irenicus is told with a lot of care. Much of the danger he poses is not from his magic, but from his cunning. He pulls Batman-like gambits all over the place, exploiting enemies and allies alike in the pursuit of something bigger, a lot bigger. He deliberately surrenders to the authorities after you escape from the lab, and it becomes obvious not 15 minutes after the tutorial dungeon that he's turning his capture into his advantage. Here's a hint. Spellhold has a lot of the same equipment he was using for his experiments, and he's all too eager to put them to use. Figure it out. Irenicus is ultimately a static villain, albeit one with a good amount of depth. But what really helps the second gate shine is it's all its other characters, the other party members who can join up with you. I mentioned Minsk earlier, and he's basically a jolly Hulk. The only reason he hasn't killed everyone else in his path is because he simply wasn't mad enough. Everybody else just sort of head sighs at the dialogue he has with his pet hamster, whom he insists is a miniature giant space hamster, which do exist apparently, but nobody's going to make fun of him because of that. Jan Janssen, a gnomish inventor, thief, illusionist, and black marketeer, is about as memorable as adventuring companions can get. Nobody, I mean nobody, is safe from his long, boring stories about turnips and farming and adventure and such that would put the cybernetic ghost of Christmas past to sleep. Put him in a party of stodgy, serious types like the paladin Keldorn or the drow cleric Viconia, and just wait for a while. You won't be disappointed. Of course, some of the characters aren't just the straight man in this. Some start out as righteous bastions of ass-kicking. Others grow into it. But quite a few change over the course of the adventure. Take Jahira, a returning character from the first game, has her own reasons for tracking Irenicus down and staying with the party, reasons which put her at odds with old friends of hers. She knows she's in the right, but being in the right means being on the wrong end of her friend's weapons, and it's on her, and you, to sort out which wrong she'd rather be. Or Valigar, the ranger with some seriously fucked up family problems, with a pathologic distrust of magic and magic users. He's not an idiot, he knows it's necessary, but he views it as a destructive force that ultimately corrupts. While his separate quest involving an ancient ancestor is a bit of an eye-opener, there's no grand epiphany that makes him okay with you or anybody else you bring along. He just grows to accept it as you fight together. Or even Viconia, whose very nature and indeed alignment are evil by default. She gets nothing but shit from every non-dark elf she's encountered, and it takes some serious chinning up by you and yours to get along to get her to change. And then there's how these personalities bounce off each other. Mazzy, a halfling warrior desperately styling herself as a paladin, takes on Valigar as her squire, without telling him. Minsk takes a comment by a noble thief/mage Nalia a bit too literally and opts to carry her when she complains about walking too much. The nihilist bard Herdalise and Jan take turns trying to out-weird each other, at least when Jan's not trying to steal Minsk's hamster, Boo. Keldorn can only shake his head and sigh at the headstrong arrogance of Annaman, a warrior cleric who isn't nearly as worldly wise as he thinks he is. And then there's Corgan, the bloodthirsty dwarven psychopath who just wants to murder every last motherfucker in the room. And then there's Lularkor, the enchanted and super-powerful talking sword, who just wants to murder every last motherfucker in the room. As I've said, I could quite literally go on for days, but let's bring all this together. The catch with all this is, you have to get to it. There's a disparity between the feel of the game, the adventure it delivers, and the frustration you have to put up with to get there. Unless you're a hardcore D&D nerd, and frankly, even if you are, and I can tell you I sure didn't know what the hell a saving throw was or how it worked, even if you know what you're getting into, it's gonna take some effort. Especially so for the first game, since the difficulty is high right off the bat, and it only lets up when you learn the ropes and get a few levels under your belt. It's not easy. And I can tell you right now, I've been playing the game about 5 years, I still get curb stomped if I blunder into the wrong room unprepared. Make no mistake, the challenge, or should I say overcoming the challenge, is a part of the game's appeal to me. And it somehow becomes manageable when you start to pay attention to what's going on, start to care about your pals and their problems. But you gotta live long enough, and I know it's not gonna appeal to everybody. Baldur's Gate is old school in the sense that nobody really makes RPGs like it anymore. I mean, okay, it's not as old as Ultima or Wasteland or something, but they almost physically can't make games like this anymore. I'm not going to be the guy that says things were better before every game had to be in 3D with full voice acting, but those things do cost more, and make it exponentially more pricey to make a really deep role-playing game, which in turn makes it more important for the game to do well. There's pretty much no going back at this point, not for the PC, not for any of the consoles. It's not impossible to do a game with the same degree of depth. From the sound of it, that's what BioWare's trying to do with Dragon Age, but it does cost more to do the same thing, which means fewer and fewer people are going to bother trying. Then again, if it means fewer This Is The New Shit trailers... Okay, just a quick tangent. You guys saw the Dragon Age Origins trailer set to Tank, right? Or the Hawaii Five-O theme? Why can't companies realize they're going into grimdark territory and poke a little fun at it? Anybody can do violence trailers set to angry rock music. I guarantee you the people you think you're trying to sell it to, they're going to pay way more attention if people are cutting each other's heads off to, I don't know, the Sanford and Son theme, or Sunshine and Lollipops or something. Lighten up a little. Throw some silliness into the life of Angry McFace Puncher, a man on the edge who's not going to take it anymore. So we're not completely off topic. I should add one final thing that makes Baldur's Gate worthwhile. It is silly at times. It's well aware of this. It has people who've read that book before and know what this must sound like. You'll never forget the spectator beholder that some moron drow summoned to guard a chest for 100 years, because the beholder is bored as hell and definitely not taking this shit seriously. You can flat out tell some asshole on Spellhold that you're killing him for reasons it wouldn't be worth the time to explain. Irenicus famously states that you warrant no villain's exposition from me when he's got you in a Bondian unsupervised death trap. So, you know, he screws up on that one, but at least he doesn't break it down to bullet points in the process. Jan Janssen has a story for f***ing everything. Jahira cuts a guy down accusing her of slander by saying, well, slander's going a bit far. You actually were a slaver, you know. It's not slander if it's proven. And, of course, Minsk, whose one and only answer to life's problems is to beat the shit out of them until they cease to be problems, or cease to be. Pair him with a talking sword and let the insanity begin. Anyway, that's Baldur's Gate. It's far from ideal. You gotta want it. And I can tell you a good ways into the it was a good ways into the game before it clicked for me. Like with Stalker, I wasn't able to gloss over the game's problems until I was well past them. But once I was, I found something really special. Something I just don't see much of in gaming today. It's big. It's well written. It's got adventure down pat. Right down to the core of the game, it's all about the adventure. It's got heart. It's got a script by someone who genuinely loves what they do. Someone who knows how to bring the drama and let it drop when they need to. It's got power. The feeling of true, honest-to-goodness progression. The feeling that you are changing along with the game. And that, my friends, is one of the best ways to get around your game's flaws. Make your player not even care about them, because the rest of the game is just that good. Now, if you excuse me, the review copy of Dragon Age has just arrived, and it's time to see if BioWare can do it again. Hey, thanks for listening to me ramble, guys. Closing with a quote. I was watching some stupid vampire movie the other day with some douche using a Desert Eagle, and I realized the Desert Eagle is actually a good weapon for hunting vampires or other supernatural stuff. It's more concealable than a long arm, yet has enough firepower to stop an elephant, which is precisely what you need when you're a low-profile hunter of hideous supernatural beasts. And then I realized why the eagle is so pathetic. It's the perfect weapon for a situation that doesn't fucking exist. And thanks for listening, folks. This is John, signing off.
Despair not. I will inspire you by charging blindly on!